Welcome to the session on taking our Torah beyond the pulpit. I'm Nina Beth Martin, and I have the privilege of moderating this. There were two sort of data points yesterday that I think helped set this up. One was when we were asking for statistics about women in the rabbinate and who we are and what we're doing, and I believe, although this sounds like it was sort of soft data, that Kelly Jones said something like, tape is going to love that, I know, right? That's just something rolling out the door. It's a little dolly rolling out the door. Don't think anything else about that sound. 40% of conservative women are in the congregation. Is that right? That's what we heard.
Yes.
But that was something of a soft number. We really do have to do better numbers for who we are, which means, of course, that if my math is right,
60%.
I think, and that's
because he was 39% was what he came up with. He was fudging that.
So 60% of us are not in congregation. The latest numbers from whatever National Jewish Population Surveys might be out there. How many Jews are unaffiliated or non-affiliated with congregations in
about
America?
90%.
So 90% of us maybe are outside of congregations. And there was a question that someone asked Abigail. I think the first question that she got yesterday was, it is wonderful that you, Abigail, put yourself forward and engaged and reconnected. And as Abigail herself acknowledged, not only had the time, well, she acknowledged that she had the time to do this, but in fact she was paid, you know, to do this. Not that she didn't choose to do that, she did, but she was so gifted and sort of, you know, privileged to be able to do that as part of her job, so that it wasn't something you had to fit in around everything else you did in your life. So the question was, how do you reach those Jews who don't come to you, who don't step in the doors of the synagogue? And that's part of what we're talking about. That's the challenge. And it's a challenge, I think, not just sort of process-wise, how to reach those Jews, but I think it is a challenge of contemporary Jewish message today too. That is, we can't just be navel-gazing about can women be rabbis, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, those are critical questions to have. But the question is, if women are rabbis, then what? What for? And not just what for ourselves, but what for? It is a big and needy world out there. You know, I come from Baltimore, and right now we're preventing Baltimore from burning down. And you know what? One of the things is, where's the Jewish community in this? What is our contribution to the prevention and not just to the solution? It is wonderful that the Jewish community is engaged now in trying to help raise money to repair, to give the children, you know, 80%, or something like 80% of Baltimore City school children are in the food, the lunch program. Mm-hmm. We're helping feed those children now that the schools are closed, right? And we are doing the things to repair, but can we be there to do the work of prevention as well? So these are big questions. And we have three women who are going to answer them. but we have three women who are really this is going to be a conversation, and one of the things that is critical for establishing the nature of this conversation is understanding who these women are and what they do and why they've chosen to do what they do. So we're just going to go down. You guys tell me who wants to start, and tell us who you are, where you are, what you do, and why you've chosen to do that.
Hi, I'm Lori Foreman Jacoby. Nice to see everybody. So I was ordained in 1988, and the past 27 years or so, my work has been outside the public world and largely in the educational world. I would say I spent a big chunk of my life being the first rabbi in residence for UJ Federation of New York. So I was there from 1995 until 2003, which was 8 years, in which I was really fortunate to have that position. I'll talk about that a little bit, and then currently I work at the JCC Manhattan, which is here in Manhattan, as the director of the Jewish Journey Project, an innovative, we say bold, you know, attempt to rethink supplemental Jewish education. It's a collaborative project with 5 Upper West Side synagogues. So I've been very proud of all the different work I've done in my career, but let me just focus on those two briefly. So when I was employed at the UJ Federation, I want to say that that was not the job I was hired to do. Okay, so I was hired to be the director of young leadership. which was a fundraising job, working with people who were, you know, in their 20s or something like that, and it lasted for about 6 months, you know, and it was, became clear that I had a lot of skills, but doing that job wasn't just one of them. And so they had the foresight, and I had the openness to say, like, let's try to find something else. And it was, you know, a particular time in history, I think. It was 1995, and so, you know, the economy was good, and people were trying to think about how to push more Jewish learning, I think, into alternative spaces. And certainly UJ Federation was, at that time, an alternative space in which to hire a rabbi. The only other rabbi I had ever hired was Philip Friedman, but he was in a position of, like, being the bring the convener and the fundraiser for the synagogues, you know, to try to get the synagogues and the rabbis behind UJ Federation's fundraising campaigns and messages, which is fine. But he wasn't an in-house teacher. So what I was able to do in that position, which was, like, so fortunate, was I was able to teach everybody from the top leadership to just stomp donors, you know, and I taught a lot of groups. So it was sort of based on that model, and I still think that it's a powerful model that other organizations have borrowed. You know, based on that model, like, you know, you go where people are. We know that other organizations do this too, without naming them. And so I did classes in law firms at 7 o'clock in the morning. I did couple groups in Westchester homes at 8 o'clock at night. You know, I went to people's homes and taught them one-on-one. And well, you know, we all don't have the time maybe to do it in such a precise and, you know, one-on-one kind of manner. It really did allow people to really do what you would consider like learning in a place that wasn't those synagogue walls. And they really loved it. They really, really loved it. And during that time, I was also able to, and I think this is also really important, was to push the organization to really clarify, well, what, you know, people love to hide behind that phrase, Jewish values, as if you say Jewish values and everybody knows what you mean. You know, it's a very broad and general phrase. And I used to try to work with fundraisers to try to say, well, when you're talking to somebody about, you know, the values behind their gift and what's motivating them to be part of this larger institution, to be a little bit more specific, you know what I'm saying? And to use really clearer language. And that was really also really important at the time. It was really early in the age of email communication and web communication. I think that, you know, there was a very early system there, and when I started in 1995. But one of the early things I did was I wrote this Jewish Thought of the Day, which some of you may be familiar with. It became two co-edited books with Rabbi Karolitsky. And I have to tell you, so many people remember me from those years. I don't know who they are. But the power, you know, we now know that the power of the network, you know, is amazing. But even then, I used to say, well, that's my bread and butter. Because this Jewish thought would go out every morning, and it would touch people. I wouldn't really know all the people it touched and who opened that email. You know, it wasn't a time when we could really, we didn't have statistics or anything like that, you know, how many people opened emails. But, it was a powerful experience, and even though after many years of doing it, it became a challenge to think of new things to say, I still think that it was really, it really touched a lot of people, and people looked for it, and it was the beginning, I think, of like, how do you get Jewish teaching online? You know, it was way before what we do today, right? I mean, it was nothing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was something. UJ Federation at the time had two rabbis when I was there, and many of you know Rabbi Michael Paley is still the rabbi of residence of UJ Federation. He's had a very long sabbatical there, and he's done incredible, incredible work there. And they continue to try to, you know, deepen the Jewish message so that people kind of understand what this huge, large institution is. And I was fortunate to work there when Dr. John Ruskin was the head of the organization. And in my little bio that is in that book, I recall, because it was so powerful to me at the time, you know, he said, you're a little tugboat, you know, pushing this to this huge organization to change. And he said, you know, don't think that's insignificant. He said, you could change the world from any corner office as long as you're, like, focused and determined. And he said that, I don't know why he said this, but Vice President Dan Quayle, actually, he said, you know, everybody wrote him off. But he did, like, so much work in his little side office, and he seemingly changed a lot of things. We may not know what they are. But so it was his example, though, of saying, you don't know how much you can do. You don't know how much you can do. And Diane is here. Diane held the same position after I left, a few years after I left at UJ Foundation. So then fast forward, had some children, I moved to the suburbs. I worked in the suburbs. I worked here a little bit. And then Joy Levin, Rabbi Joy Levin, who is the executive director of JCC Manhattan, decided that she was going to try to, like, remake afternoon supplementary education, and really through her relationships and her leverage and many, many other factors that went into it, she was able to raise a good amount of philanthropic dollars, and we were able to launch something called the Jewish Journey Project. It's a partnership with 5 Upper West Side synagogues. So this is really the work I'm doing now, which is, how are we going to teach our children and families, how are we going to connect them Jewishly outside the model, or parallel to the model of what you call Hebrew school? Because most Hebrew schools are not teaching Hebrew, and most of them are not schools. We continue to say Hebrew school, and parents continue to say Hebrew school. You know, it's giving the wrong message, really. And people today need, so the pillars of my program are flexibility, and I'll tell you what that means, collaboration, innovation, and community. So we have kids from all these 5 or 6 institutions, and I put out a bunch of courses that they can take. And so flexibility is, people need flexibility. I don't know where you live, but, like, people in New York City and in New Jersey, like, they just can't commit to every Monday and Wednesday or every Tuesday and Thursday or whatever the schedule is. So every semester they get to choose classes from a wide range of classes in which I pushed a lot of different kinds of modalities. So nobody has the same Jewish journey. We're not worried, really, about them all learning the same thing at the same time. We're really worried about them being engaged in the process of choosing how they're going to deepen their Jewish identity through what modality it's going to speak to them, whether it's like ritual and ceramics, whether it's a creative dance class in which they learn how to do a creative dance around, you know, Yom Suf or something. There's a lot of creative arts in the program, and they get badges as they move along this pathway, and we're just finished our 3rd year. But without telling you about the design of it, and I'm happy to speak to you about that later, what I really find is that, you know, people, and there's 1 conservative synagogue, 2 reconstructionist synagogues, and 1 non-affiliated synagogue, but that is BJ. So it's not affiliated, but it's BJ, right? So who I work with, and the families are all the same. You know what I'm saying? The families are really pretty much all the same. There's a lot of intermarried families. There's a lot of families who really, really struggle because they really do want to give their kids something. But they themselves, and you've heard this before, you know, we need to structure it for them. We need to create structures for them that is inviting for the parents as well. Meaning, if it's not inviting for the parents, it's not going to be inviting for the kids, okay? If the parents are stressed out and can't figure out how to move their kids from school to afternoon activities and all this other stuff, we can. I just wrote an article, you know, I bemoaned how over-scheduled students are, and they are over-scheduled. Did I move the needle? I didn't move any needle at all. I just had to get it out, you know what I'm saying? So really what we try to do is, we try to say, take as many of these wonderful courses that you can fit into your schedule. We're going to sit with you. We're going to have one-on-one advising. We're going to get to know you as a family. We meet with every family twice a year. And that allows them to say, I know you want to do Krav Maga again. Please do Krav Maga again. But let's think about, you know, taking it alongside this other course I'm offering back-to-back. You know, That's like Jews around the world or something. So I really think that the families I work with are looking for meaning and looking for, but they're past denominations. I really do think that it's a post-denominational world for others, maybe not for those of us in this institution, but that's where they are. And so lastly, I just want to say, I pushed Hebrew, and I know everybody wondered, oh, Hebrew. I think it's like the biggest elephant in the room. So I have 175 kids online once a week for 30 minutes doing a one-on-one Hebrew tutorial on a platform called WizIQ, which is any one of those, webinar platforms. You could do it on WebEx. You could do it on any one of them. But what we do is like focus 30 minutes. You're reading to somebody who went to Camp Ramah or went to base. I have like kids in all the colleges and all the high schools who do this for me as tutors. And I have a spreadsheet. They got it. So this is what first the kids have to know, like Chazakatni wrote. Then they have to know Hamotzi. Then they have to know, Chazakat, let's say Chanukah. Then they have to know Hashikva. It's not only Tefillah. You could certainly say that we don't do enough Tefillah in my program. However, and this is a big, big issue, what does it mean to do Tefillah midweek in this way we've done it for years and years and years when people just don't come to shul? Is that really the right use of this time? And I know that there are repercussions to that, and I'm making a statement, but I don't know if it really helps develop their neshama or their soul or their connection to liturgy or any of those things when it's outside an authentic experience and where the parents are not taking them to shul. They're just not, really. One of our synagogues, because I just want to say one thing. So one of our synagogues, parallel to taking all these classes, they have to go to their home institution on a regular basis. So some people do that on a weekly basis. They go back to their home institution. We call it Nida. That's the time when this home institution can pass on their values, their nusach, their vision, their mission. And SAJ moved that meetup to Shabbat, from the weekday afternoon. And they have transformed their Shabbat by doing that, because now they have kids and parents in the building at the same time, and they have, they have davening and sort of like those kind of breakouts you hope you remember from camp afterwards, and then everybody goes into davening a little bit and Kiddush together. So, look, there's no one answer, but I really think that the issue of if they're not going to come to us, we have to go to them. There's a lot of creative ways of doing that. There are people who are teaching in Barnes & Nobles. There are people who are teaching, in storefronts and things like that. And I think that is an important step. It's not that be all in all, but it is important to go where people are, because they're just not coming otherwise.
So I hope you're taking notes, writing down questions, because we will come back and open up the conversation for you in a minute. There's a lot to delve into there and to talk about there. So let me just take one pause before we go on to Sarah. I don't know about you, but I was wondering last night how many people would be coming to this session.
Yes.
I know it's not exactly, but we might be worried about that. You probably were thinking about that. This is actually a bigger crowd than I anticipated.
Yeah,
which
four times the size. I was always hoping that we'd have more people here than analysts.
Yeah, me too. So how many of you, first of all, let's find out baseline, how many of you are conservative rabbis? Okay, so we've got the right audience here. How many of you work within the synagogue bounds? And how many of you, therefore, work outside the synagogue? It's about half.
Or both. This is an ideal set of participants.
Right, because one of the things... Because these are not diametrically opposed, locations. These locations have to be intertwined and integrated, interconnected. So we'll get more on that later.
So how many of you, just to see where I'm sitting, have read Being Mortal by Atul Gawande? One.
How about that person?
Not yet.
Okay.
Have you heard of this? I have it on my shelf.
Okay. Okay. So how many of you see the headline about the wave of people aging in this country and the concern put in there? And end-of-life decision-making, or had a statute put up in your state about decision-making at the end of life? Okay. So here's to just open up the context of what health happens in a large elder care context. I serve as the spiritual care director for Cooper Senior Life. For those of you who are not from Boston, in case there's any here, that is in the city of Boston, in Brookline, in Canton, Randolph, Revere, and Dedham. We have campuses. So we interface with about 4,000 seniors every day, about 3,000 of whom are Jewish. And some of those are rotating in and out very quickly through rehab care. So it's not just the same, that's on one day. So over the course of a year, you can magnify that number for the Boston Jewish community. So there's the elders themselves. I have a team of 12 chaplain rabbis who are, one, doing direct care, two, interfacing with all those families, serving as full members of palliative care teams so that when issues come up, there's challenges, our director of palliative care is actually trained in chaplaincy as well and interfaces the rabbi into those pieces. And any person who gets a referral for palliative care, the first person to call them could be the nurse practitioner, could be the chaplain on that team. So we've got a fully integrated model at this point. So I'm 11 years into this job. When I got there, it was sort of shtiebel rabbi. It was someone walking around telling jokes, doing funerals, and doing a little bit of on-time care when there was time for it. I built this team. We now have chaplains at every one of our sites. We have a CPE education program, so we have chaplains, a Jewish one. So predominantly, hidden truth, we keep more than 50% of our students Jewish in order to try and have a program where people, where rabbinical students, where people in the field wanting to come back and do chaplaincy at some point in their life can have a Jewish formation process in a context where we are doing it from a Jewish theological and cultural perspective, given that there's very few places you can go that have hospital-level Jewish care, meaning at a hospital level where most of your patients are going to be Jewish. And so it gives us this place. We're also Harvard's Geriatric Research Center. So we have doctors and interns and residents and nursing students coming in and out all the time, as well as active research going on. So layers. Layers of how we reach the community. There are the residents or the patients or the people in independent living themselves. There are all their family members, of whom many of the chaplains serve on family councils, but more importantly, have family members coming back doing, whether it's bereavement or whether it's honoring, but just coming back. Whether it's to a service or to a class, if they've joined your kahal, they're still there. We have most recently started a hospice service where we now have 40 volunteers who are in our educational zone on a monthly basis, as well as interpreting the meaningful work they're doing. And for many of them, that's their primary affiliation. We have the friends of the organization, which slightly functions like Hadassah or something, meaning there's large groups of people, for because we're a 100-year-old organization, we are one of the places you sort of belong to, and if we reach those people, it's another point of potential affiliation and education. We have a 2,400-person staff, many of whom are not Jewish, but who are part of this community, a whole other educational level on many zones. And for a few years, I've tried to do something with the holidays where we're actually using them for staff care so that around Rosh Hashanah, we're finding universal Rosh Hashanah values to bring out there so that it's not simply I have to do extra hours to get these people dressed because all these family members are coming and everyone has to look good. Not that they don't get them dressed well otherwise, but you know, it takes that extra oomph and the kitchen staff is working overtime and everything else. So how do we take these times when staff are working more anyway and make them caring times for the staff? Okay, so these are the sort of internal challenges one might have. Another piece is education out in the community. Now, Boston is the heart of Atul Gawande and the Conversation Project, if you've heard of that one. There's a lot of work going on out there that's making this. How do we, as a very medicine research-oriented community, pay attention to this added part of life that we have added and what it means and when is it over. Or when is it not over because we need to figure out how to give meaning to that time. And so I'm currently just, wasn't here on time yesterday because I was getting a funding pass to have an education, a person more fully in the community doing education around that. So it's an exciting place to be. I'd rather work from questions having put that out there.
All right, thank you. All right, so hang on to your questions. We're coming to you.
That's amazing. My sister, very talented woman, she is one of the principals of an organization, a business called Leading Edge Coaching and Development. And she and her business partner, she lives in Connecticut, her business partner lives in Minneapolis, go all over the country, and they, since they both have a background in acting, they have this very interesting and engaging way of teaching, which always involves doing these scenes, you know, and communication might look like if you're not listening to each other, you know, and then they do a scene, and then they go, scene. So my sister has, in all of these places that she goes, profit, nonprofit, NIH, you know, some big corporation, community colleges, she has these set things that she just tweaks, you know. She finds out the name of somebody's boss, and they put it in, and so she has these set stories that she tells, and one of the stories is about me. And it always gets a big laugh, even though it's a bit tragic. The story she tells about me is, my sister is a rabbi. Yeah, she's a rabbi. She's a weird job, you know, for a little, you know, she buries people, she sings, you know, she writes stuff, like weird stuff. She describes my career. And yeah, it's very strange. It's very strange. She wants to, you know, just emphasize just the strangeness of the eclectic nature of my job. And that already gets a laugh, but that's not the point of the story. The point of the anecdote that she tells is that when my daughter was, my daughter who now serves in the IDF, thank you, finally, I have some Zionist credibility. Your daughter serves in the IDF, you are unimpeachable. So,
didn't work so with Michael Lerner.
No, I know. So she tells this story, and it's about when my daughter was, I don't know, maybe 14 or 13 or something, innocently asked me one day, apropos really of nothing, she turns to me and she goes, Mom, what do you do for fun? And as my sister tells the story, I burst into tears. Actually, I don't think I did, but it's an excellent story. So all of you, anyone who's ever given a sermon knows, embellishment isn't really lying. So supposedly I burst into tears. Even if I didn't burst into tears, it really bothered me. What do I do for fun? You know, and I could say, oh, my work is my fun. But what do I do? That wasn't really the question that she was asking. She knew I was happy being a rabbi most of the time. But she wasn't really asking that. She was like, what do you do to sort of replenish yourself? You know? So I thought about this, and I decided to do something. So 5 years later,
we finally found the time.
Every year I'd say, this is the year I'm going to have fun. You know, when you're up there on high holidays, they don't know what you're thinking. I'm thinking like, I'm going to have fun this year. The rest of them are like repenting for having had fun. But I'm thinking, I'm going to do something for myself. And so a couple of years ago, I decided that I would sign up at the West Hartford Art League to take an art course I had not taken an art course since college, and I signed up for pastels. The reason I signed up for pastels is I love the look of pastel paintings. I think it's just gorgeous, very rich, vibrant colors. And so I took this pastels course, and I wasn't that great at it. Like, it brought me anxiety, you know? And I do have a few pastel paintings, and, you know, I wasn't bad at it, but I was so tentative. Because pastels is a very unforgiving form of art. You put something down, you can't just keep covering it up. There's only so much pastel pigment that the paper will accept. And so, this is how I would do it. Pause. Pause. I was just working on the same pastel painting for like week after week. And I realized, maybe I'm not having that much fun. Because this is not supposed to bring me anxiety. What I really wanted to take, the reason I took pastels besides liking the look of pastels is, it fit into my schedule. Yes. So it met on Mondays, and I had Mondays off, you know, so to speak. And what I really wanted to take for years, because I had congregants who were involved in this wonderful collage class. But that met on Thursday mornings, and Thursday mornings for years and years I had taught a Torah study class which morphed into a Talmud study class. And these ladies, most of them ladies, had built their entire week schedule around this certain period of time. Mahjong was after, lunch was this. Anyway, so I couldn't change it. But then I stopped a volunteer job that I was doing. I taught once a week for 5-6 years with two other colleagues, a Christian and a Muslim colleague. We taught in a middle school for boys from underserved families in Hartford. We taught religion. So, and that I'll relate to in a minute. So that was on Wednesday mornings. And all of a sudden, and finally we stopped doing this course. All of a sudden Wednesdays were open. Meanwhile, some people had moved away, a couple of people died. All of a sudden I said, I'm going to see if I can move the class. So I moved the class. I just have to say one thing about pastels. I got an unbelievably phenomenal High Holiday sermon out of it. So, completely worth it. You know? Honestly, and actually I sent it to my pastels teacher. Actually from Wyoming. She's like, oh my gosh. I used her name in it, Shauna Shane, if you want to look her up. So I started taking collage this past year, and that's what I really wanted to take. Collage is extremely forgiving. Extremely forgiving. If you don't like what you made, cut it up and do something else with it. What is the essence of collage? The essence of collage is taking bits and bobs and things that appear, you know, that may be beautiful in themselves and may be sort of nondescript, taking old pieces, used things, recycling things, being on the lookout all the time for little things that could add to a collage. And then assembling those bits and pieces and ephemera into something completely new. But not completely new. Because if you look really closely at a collage, right, because it draws you in, you see, oh, that was a piece from, you know, an Israeli ad. I always put a lot of Hebrew in my collages. And so it's not complete, it's not de novo. What it is, it's an assemblage, and it's a transformational act, and it's creative. And I love collage. And just last week in my collage class, she gives us these exercises at the beginning, and then we work on our own stuff. So she gives us this exercise, an exercise in spring, because finally it seemed, although it was really freezing last week, but seemed to be coming to Connecticut. And see spring, right? And I start pasting things down. And it's one of the only things that I do in my life where I'm not like so, you know, reflective and, you know, booklets, you know, with sources, you know. It's just very spontaneous. And then I thought, wait a second, I have this old collage that I hated. And I had just like brought a piece, cut in half or something, brought a piece of it. And I took that old collage, which I hated, and I like cut pieces from it. And it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. And I stuck on some other stuff, bird's nest, whatever. But it was really beautiful. And for the first time, I framed one of my collages. So why do I tell you this? Because I think that for my rabbinate and for many of us, what we do is a collage. Right? And having now been a rabbi for 27 years, I know that I take bits and pieces from my experience, from what I've learned from students, and all the things. My eyes are always open. My sister and I took a walk the other day. You know, the sister who tells the crappy story about me. And as we're walking along, I'm like picking stuff up. And she says, you know, I walk with you, and I'm thinking, like, what the hell is she going to pick up next? And why did she choose that thing? And she said, and then she was just, like, joking about it. She goes, oh, I picked up a leaf. She goes, oh, that leaf, because that's so different than all the other thousands of leaves that we've passed. But, you know, we all develop that discerning eye. And we, when something touches us, we might not be able to explain it, but we know it. And that metaphor, and I'm thinking, by the way, this is another high holiday sermon I can squeeze out of the thing that I do for fun. I hope that doesn't take the fun out of it, but that's what we do. That's what we do. We take these bits and pieces. So I'm always on the lookout for these interesting ideas. These interesting ideas. My rabbinate, I'm currently a congregational rabbi. I've been a rabbi for 27 years. I think about 18 of those years, I've been a pulpit rabbi, congregational rabbi, always in a solo pulpit. And for the remaining years, I was director of Camp Ramah, and very drawn to the idea of not just informal education, which I am always drawn to, but the idea of creating, and you said something about authenticity, creating an authentic environment, what we call environmental education, which is not what Nina does. Nina's involved in environmental stuff, not that kind of environmental stuff, but creating an entire environment, a gestalt, right? So that if you're talking about Bikur Cholim, you actually go do Bikur Cholim. And one of the things that's cool about operating in a congregational context is you have the opportunity to plug in to authentic Jewish experiences whenever you want, and to marry those two things of Jewish education and congregational life. So I was director of Camp Ramah, and I had been very influenced as a young person working in Camp Ramah as a counselor in a Rosh Eidah. And I also was a consultant to congregations for the Bureau of Jewish Education of Greater Boston. I was a consultant to congregations. I was adjunct at Hebrew College. I was director of family education, director of congregational change, congregational transformative educational change. So I could go on, because the consultants did not get a raise for four long years, but We kept getting to add titles. So
you could raise titles.
Yeah, so, you know, every year I'd have, like, another title, and, you know, it was impressive. So so in all those capacities, I worked with congregations, and I worked with preschool directors and all kinds of groups, people doing family education. And finally, I felt like I was kissing through a veil. You know, I said, I got to get on the front lines again here. And it had to do with also, they asked, after 4 years of no raise, they asked us to take a pay cut, do the same job in 4 days that we were doing in five. So I said, time to go back to the congregation. I always had a little shul on the side. it's important to have a shul on the side. So that you cut. I told my children this is our country home. And we would go from Newton, Massachusetts to Andover, where we slept in the shul. And I remember my kids, once we went to a bar mitzvah in Lexington, a Temple of Muna in Lexington, and my friend had arranged for us to be able to sleep in the Shabbat guest room, which was the place where they stored the USY bowling trophies and all the lifetime supply, evidently, of prizes for the poor carnival. Yeah. And anyway, we walk in, there's like these subrachana broken couches and, you know, fold-out couches. Whatever. We walk in, my kids go, "Mom, this is the best shul we've ever slept in." And I just remember turning to my husband and saying, "I hope they never found out about hotels." Anyway, so I had a shul on the side. And then I went back to congregational work, which I started my rabbinate doing congregational work. So right now I'm in a congregation. So it's a funny thing. They asked me to be on this panel, which is, you know, what's the work that's not necessarily congregational. And I guess what I want to say is two things. One is that my congregational work is like my collage making. And so one of the things that being a congregational rabbi allows me to do is to like see all these little creative bits and bobs that are going on all over the country and in Israel as well. But to see, would that work in this context? And right? So bringing those things into congregational life. Furthermore, taking the bits of congregational life and bringing them out. So some of the things that I do are in the context of, you know, under the aegis of the JCC or, you know, just so interesting. My friend Carolyn Braun said to me last night, she said, one of my congregants owns a distillery. So one night a week, I don't know if it's Wednesday night or whatever, she says, "I just go there for a couple hours, 2-3 hours, and I just sit there, and I don't have, you know, study sheets or anything, and people come, right? It's all about relationships. We read it, but we knew it before we read it. And currently, I've been working for about a year with a small group of people. I'm the only rabbi in this group. But with this group that was convened by the director of our JCC, and I coined it the Dream Team, and we meet and we just throw around ideas, some of them wild and some of them not so much, but trying to figure out how the JCC, which is a very, already a very Jewishly infused place, if I can put it that way, what would the JCC look like? What if we reimagined ourselves and reimagine what the J part of the JCC might be, to cast a wider net, to go deeper. I already do some of my teaching, and so I have a women's thing that I do at the JCC. So, and we're thinking about, just like that exercise, how would you, I used to do with family educators, you know, when you walk into a home, how do you know it's a Jewish home, you know, that exercise? So now you can do it. What would you see this, you'd see that, you know, what would you hear, what would you smell? So, by the way, it's very effective to do it with a dollhouse, just saying. And the same exercise that I've done with, as a congregational consultant a million times. Somebody walks into your synagogue building, what do they see? And even, like, physically take people in and see, you know, what do they see, what do they experience? So this would be now for the JCC, both in and out of it. They have a pool club. They have, what's Jewish about it? What do they see? Our JCC is open on Shabbat. When they come in on Shabbat, is it different? The JCC director said to me, "You know what? I always want to do something for Shabbat. Like, maybe the lights are dimmed in the hallways, and maybe there's a big banner that says Shabbat Shalom, and maybe there's this, and maybe..." So we're putting together a collage of those ideas and figuring out how congregations can be a part of this and how we can be beyond congregations with beyond, you know, and all around and really no holds barred, trying to really free those creative juices. So now when my daughter asks what I would do for fun, I say, I just do collage.
Thank you. That was fabulous. Are you guys ready to start sharing, asking questions, jumping in? Yeah? So, okay, let's begin.
I want to begin with Jeff and maybe about talking about what are some of your favorite bibs and bobs that you've actually brought in.
So one thing is music, and I think that this is like a no-brainer now. You know, it's very obvious now that we bring in a lot of music. Part of this I've always done because I was, so much of me was formed, so much of my religious self was formed through USY and Camp Ramah. I didn't go to Camp Ramah as a camper, by the way, but as a staff member, and it was all singing. And go back to our synagogues, and it was so deadening for so many reasons. And so I always, you know, now I was very active in USY, and I was a regional officer for like 100 years, and every Shabbat I'd go to a different shul, and we would always rate the rabbis. And of course, at that point, I didn't think I would be a rabbi, but I always, you know, like rate the rabbis as to how open they were to engaging with youth, you know? And I just remember thinking so many times, the rabbis that we really liked, I used to think to myself, do they really like it here? I mean, do they, because these are great guys, you know, they love, you know, interacting with us, and aren't they really bored? And are they stirred by this? I was just so, you know, I didn't really ask them, but I just couldn't believe it, that these cool guys would really like this. So I've always done a lot of things very participatory. Our services are very participatory. They're not formal. And so I've worked in congregations that were open to that. You know, it's hard to come in to an extremely formal place and create, you know, a Camp Ramah davening kind of thing. So that was sort of my baseline was, you know, let's daven like Camp Ramah. You know, like there's no tomorrow, whatever. But with all of, you know, and with all of the really, you know, the Piyut project and you know, Shirat Hadasha tunes and, you know, fertilization of tunes and ideas and experiences between here and Israel, I bring that in all the time. I bring in, you know, and I engage people around music. And I have to say, I don't have a good musical ear. I have actually a good voice. I sang Zamir Karel, and so I have no compunction about getting up and singing. But it's hard for me to memorize a new tune. And so I have to really work at it. And I do. I listen to these tapes, and, you know, and I'm singing. Sometimes I want to introduce, like, a new Lahad Odi tune. I got to work on it. And then, you know what happens to me sometimes? And my congregation knows this. I get to Lahad Odi, and now I realize, I think I'm visual. I know I'm visual. I just have to have maybe some musical notation there. But as I'm walking to shul every Friday night, I think, I should have had some musical notation for this week. But I know it. I'm singing the tune. We get to Lahad Odi, and I go. So now I have these people who prepare Lahad Odi tunes. And, you know, once in a while, if they're not there, I'll just lead something I really know. But they prepare Lahad Odi tunes. And there's especially this little boy who comes with his parents, and I'll just go, and then we learn a tune to the Lahad Odi. So that's just, you know, an example. Yes.
So it raises a question, though, because the question was, what bibs and bobs, those are the words that you use to bring in. And you go back to congregations. And I know I worked as a Jewish educator at JCC, and my relationship with the congregations and synagogues in the area was that my job was to bring people who are not currently in congregations into congregational life. What do you see as the goal? I mean, including, we'll start down with, you know, with Laura. What is the goal of this extra synagogue work that we do? Is it to be in service to synagogues, or is there something ultimately, you know, appropriate and fulfilling in and of itself? So, Laura, you want to start?
I don't think it's to be in service of synagogues. No. I think it's to be in service of the person who's in front of you and the family who's in front of you. And we certainly, you know, are in relationship with synagogues like as an institution, and if they want an introduction, if they want instruction, somebody we're not in formal partnership with, you know, we can pick up the phone to anybody. But so many people are looking for something outside synagogues, and we could bang our head on the wall forever and say, well, what can we do to get them to be members? But really we have to spend the time in, you know, what can we do to make them feel good about being Jewish? Because they just don't even feel good about being Jewish so often.
And is there a vision of affiliation beyond feeling good about being Jewish?
Affiliation to a synagogue.
Affiliation to the, yeah.
Okay. There is no, for me, there is no compunction. I think that, you know, Bethany Horowitz's work that she did a long time ago, it was called Jewish Journeys, maybe my project was named after it. I have to ask Joy about that.
Yeah.
But Dr. Bethany Horowitz did this, and, you know, she talked about how, you know, we live really long lives, and our relationship to Judaism and to being Jewish and to our identities, they really change and morph over every decade. And, you know, I think we have to have more confidence in people that, you know, we're in relationship with them and we're giving them something, and then it's going to morph and become something else in their 50s. I mean, you know that people in their 50s are totally different than people in their 40s and in their 30s. Every decade, I really truly believe, has new and different challenges. And that as people have challenges in their lives, they may either come back to Judaism or they may leave Judaism for a while. But I don't really think that going into this by saying you're only part of us if you pay a membership fee and call yourself affiliated is really reflective of how people experience themselves. They also experience themselves.
Can I say something out there?
Because
I really, you asked in some of your questions, thinking like, what is Torah that we're talking about that we take beyond the pulpit? And in thinking about that, I really do see this incredibly, at times, strong or thin or precious thread between generations. And when you can really cultivate that thread and can make it, it could be connecting it to Torah in a more relevant or open way, but it could be just protecting that thread in such that at the time that aging gets tough, or at the times that families disperse, or at the times that families alienate each other, you actually are nurturing that thread. To me, that's Torah beyond the pulpit. That's intense and beautiful Torah beyond the pulpit.
And I think even the question that it's an old, you know, to me it's an outmoded question, and to you I know it is too, right? Do you deal with is your objective affiliation? And we know when that question is asked, it always means synagogue affiliation. So I think it's just the wrong question to ask right now. What does it mean to be affiliated? And affiliated is just, I mean, that the word should be abolished in terms of the questions we should be asking. What does it mean to help people engage more deeply with Torah and with leading a mitzvah-centered life? What does that, you know, what does that look like? And what are all the myriad ways that we can help people deepen and enlarge their Jewish experience and connect with Torah? And I think for all of us, Torah is at the center of what we do, no matter what the institution looks like. I think that Torah is really at the center.
I'd like to reverse.
Well, I just want to say one quick thing. So I recently had the experience like, my father passed away in March in Los Angeles, and I grew up in Los Angeles, but there's not that many people left in Los Angeles. So I went back to Los Angeles, and my husband and daughter came after the funeral, and couldn't get me any. And it was such an interesting situation. So somebody said that there's an organization in LA called Shiva Sisters, for you LA people, right? So interesting. We looked online. You know, I could see, like, if I wasn't who I was, I could see how at that moment this Shiva Sisters would have been a great for a non-affiliated person who's just going somewhere and needs help putting something together would have been an amazing thing to reach out to. They talk about their party planners. They seem to offer a lot of different services. I'm sorry, that's my phone. And
it's the sugar sister's calling.
Yeah. But here's the thing. You know, when my son passed away in June, and you know, I lived in Teaneck. Well, in Teaneck, I mean, I was really held. I was held for 9 months by a community. So within these two experiences, in the same year, the same person, there was a moment when I had the community and everybody was very connected to me, and there was a moment when I had to leave that community to attend to something, and there was no, I mean, there was little connection, you know. And there was no shul. I mean, there was a shul. I had to drive to get to shul, which I don't usually do. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. The point is that it's the same thing along people's life. There are points when they're very connected. There are points when maybe they're not so connected. And we have to think about it as that they can always find that we can always be open to them coming back in some way. And it may not be how we want, by the way, but they can always come back.
One of my favorite aspects I think about now is this doula system. You know, why should just postpartum women get doulas? I mean, I think at various stages in our lives we need doulas, and I think having a Jewish doula
mothers
system.
Mothers of 18.
I'm telling you, there's nobody I know of who doesn't need a doula for that. And if we could have Jewish doulas, you know, to do this, the Shiva sisters would be great. I want to go to JB and then, okay, 1, 2, 3, yes.
So I just sort of first of all just want to. Thank you for your, as we celebrate 30 years of women in the rabbinate, for all of your presence, both for me as a person and a professional. You've all really enriched my being and my rabbinate, and I respect you and adore you and love you, and thank you for all that you have done and are doing, and really that's from my heart. I think that for me, what each of your examples is showing is that we still are, you know, living, there's like this one small session with wonderful, fabulous exemplars of outside the pulpit, because we still are thinking, our institutions are still thinking, and the Jewish people are still thinking, that pulpit and synagogue and institutional framework and the way that Judaism, and your question is like, how many people are in the pulpit, how many rabbis are in the pulpit, how many are not, how many Jews are affiliated, how many are not. And we haven't allowed feminism to influence our cultural constructs and our way of framing and being and doing Jewish life. And that really is that we need to stop thinking of what is the halakhic framework that we need to impose on people, or cultural thing that we want them to do, or Torah on people. And we need to do what Lori said, and that all of you do, and that is we need to engage people and help them to find meaning in their lives and connect it up to the piece of them that resonate with Jewishness and Judaism in whatever ways. Because right now, with 90% unaffiliated, most Jews in the world treat the synagogue with a respectful irrelevance. And we aren't honoring that at all by having synagogue being part of our framework whatsoever. we need to have put 90% of our energy, if that's the case, into creative modes of engagement wherever people are. And we need to, you know, bring the synagogue outside of the synagogue and into the synagogue. We need to be doing things that are not synagogue. I mean, we're like, we need to flip the model upside down. You know, the programming in my synagogue is not distinctively text-based at all. We are trying to bring people in, and then when we go out, we do other things. And I think that there's a million models, but the standard model that seems to be the paradigm off of which we think of ourselves as alternative needs to be flipped, so that the alternative is what the small percentage of synagogue doers do, and the rest of us, the rest of the world, if we want Judaism to thrive, and not just to see who we can get to stay connected so it doesn't die out, is to really work on what you guys are doing and think about all the kinds of alternatives, and that you as women and feminism is brought with flexibility, community, innovation, collaboration, environmental thinking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I just want to lay that out and thank you for starting a conversation that should be the conversation that really is the paradigm for the whole conference and for the movement and what we do.
Just respond to that for a minute. The other day, I had an interesting experience. A woman who used to be affiliated with my synagogue and who left some years ago, she got upset about something. I saw her after, one of those events that I was going to every night, you know, Yom HaShoah, Yom HaZikaron. So I saw her after one of those events, and she ran out of the Israeli dance program that she was in. And she threw her arms around me, and she said, "I want to thank you for what you're doing." I have no idea what she was talking about. But she said, somebody, I talked to somebody who was saying terrible things about Muslims and about Islam, and I referred that person to you, and I hope she calls you back. I don't know if she will, but I felt so good that you're involved in all these things and you stand up for this and what you post on Facebook. And I thought, you have not been my congregant for years. This is the most substantive conversation we have ever had, now that you're not my congregant. And I had no idea that this woman is even like on this wavelength. And I do a lot of interfaith work, which has deepened my own relationship, not only with the people I know, I've come to know, but my own relationship with Judaism.
Yes.
And here was this woman, and I thought, wow, like, I never thought about, like, all these different things, and she's so happy because a Jewish person, and it makes me think of the kinds of things that you're doing right now, because a Jewish person is involved in all these different things, and she's keyed into that. You know, so you never.
Good to you, thank you.
And to call this woman unaffiliated, because I know she hasn't joined another thing, call this woman unaffiliated would be so idiotic. So idiotic.
Yes, yes.
Wait, we were going, you were next, I think, right? Okay. Yeah,
okay. Can you introduce yourself?
Okay, Danielle Upton, and I'm in Clearwater. So I've had a congregational rabbinate and a non-congregational rabbinate, and they're both fun in different ways. But I might be, at some point in the future, I'm just curious, other people might be interested in this as well. If you're not affiliated with an institution, right, if you're kind of like going out on your own, how do you monetize? Like going out to the community. I've been asked by groups, young professionals, I'm a young professionals group, they're amazing. But if I'm not representing an institution, like I know I'm gonna go out Lishma and because I love them and want I care about their souls. But like I'm not gonna get paid for that work. Or like if someone wants to bring me in to do like a session or a series or whatever, I mean like how do you monetize when you're just kind of like out there?
You gotta ask for money, lady. That's my worst thing. You know, my husband is always saying to me, "Oh, are they paying you for this?" And I go like, "Oh, I don't really know." This is after years and years. And he goes, "You are like the worst at this." But we have to put ourselves out there. And I'm not saying don't ever do anything lishma, but choose very carefully. You have to be getting something major out of this. What's her name? The third woman who was ordained in the Reform movement, Laura Geller. Laura Geller once said, you know, people ask me to speak about women and work the rabbit. You know, people ask me to speak all the time. And she said, I used to feel like, oh, I have this obligation to speak because, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she said, I very quickly learned that if I'm going to say yes to something that I don't absolutely have to do as just part of whatever my job is, if I'm going to say yes to something, I have to ask myself, what am I getting out of it? Either I'm getting a lot of money, right? Decent, or fair market value, right? For doing this. Or I'm doing it because this is going to be tremendous exposure for me and it's really worth it.
Because, you know, there's a limit. You know, I've been exposed for so long. I don't do anything for that anymore. Enough of it. Enough of the exposure. Oh, this could lead to money. No, no. Or the third thing she said was that you feel so passionately about, like, this is just, you're doing it for incredible sipuk nefesh. And she said, it really better be, like, this is going to nourish your soul. So you, if you're not institutionally engaged, you know, and you don't have like a regular salary.
I think we need to learn from Chabad to be really,
yeah,
to be really upfront,
yeah,
about this.
I agree.
Think that right now we're put in the position of saying no when we can't get money for those things, and it's the Chabad rabbis who are saying yes. And we need to create a model where there are more, the way the economy is right now, if we don't figure out a model to be tapping from people who have the ability to pay someone like you to do all those things very easily and allow us to be engaging with the people without putting a price tag on it, we're losing.
But there is a role for the movement to play to normalize what it is that you're going to be setting yourself up as yes.
The movement could set up those
positions. We need to do that.
Right.
Did you?
It does need to be monetized.
You want to talk on this?
Yeah, I want to talk about this. I know that up in the Berkshires, which is just across the state line from where I am in Albany, there is a rabbi named Caius Stern Kaufman who really started an organization from the ground up called Rimon. You can Google them. And part of what she did was she wrote some grant proposals. And if you can get yourself organized enough to write grant proposals and find the people who give the money, then you may be able to monetize it beyond saying, yeah, I'll come and do a program, you know, but in addition to my expenses and my travel, this is what I want to do.
I want to go to Ilana. I promise.
My husband and I, we are the startup Jewish family. We started a shul together 13 years ago, but 5 years ago I started something called the Women's Jewish Learning Center. And I get some grants. I have private donors. I think, and
you charge for courses
and so on. And you know, pays me a salary. And I think that great people and great ideas can find funding. I really do.
But I want to go back to the point where the movement can assist individual entrepreneurs in this effort by saying this is a standard of practice that is recognized. And so when someone comes to you as a funder, you know, or as a student, and you see this. Otherwise, looking at this individual who's, like, you know, sort of out there, loose and foot and foot loose and fancy free, they're not. They are absolutely. They are creating. This is what you were talking about: new models, new establishments. They are creating a niche here, a franchise here of a standard model of practice for the contemporary rabbinate, so it won't look like such a heavy lift and it won't look so odd.
But
so,
Nina, are you saying that the movement currently can do that?
Yes.
Or is that yes. Can you explain? Because I'm hearing. I know what I'm thinking. I'm kind of hearing. How can the movement do that now?
Well, I was just speaking to Paula MacDrill saying that there is a strategic plan that's being undertaken by the Rabbinical Assembly. I think we ought to contribute our thoughts to the strategic planning process of the Rabbinical Assembly. Say this is one opportunity where we can expand the construction of the idea of what is the standardized role of a model of a rabbi. I mean, I don't know how many of us who are outside the congregation, when we're first introduced as rabbis, first question we ask is,
where's
the congregation? Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Exactly.
And we got to change that question. Who was, you were next? Or okay, you'll be next and then you'll be third. Okay.
I thought your question before was backwards on some level. You know, about there is a purpose to. I think that, you know, somehow teaching congregations how to be available to people, you know, is important. Debbie, when you said, you know, you used to go around, you know, and rate
rabbis
and congregations, right? I think part of our problem is that there's like a small group of people who like maintain or keep up congregations who are invested in the model that's boring to everybody else. And how to overcome that is always a big struggle. But congregations can't sit around and say, you know, we have this model of a congregation and people have to like fit into our model. We have to figure out how we reach out to those people and do something that's worthwhile and meaningful to them rather than to come and them to pay tribute to us. I mean, it seems to me that's you know what we learn from the you know from the people who are doing stuff outside of synagogues. That synagogues have to learn from them rather than seeing them as either competition or you know. But to say, what can we learn? What, how can we make ourselves a place where people want to come in and extend their you know their experience? I'm no good at getting money, you know, and that's why I have such a terrible career. But
let me ask if you want to respond.
Yeah.
Affirmation all around.
I'm Deborah Zucker, in a congregation for now. I do think that the money question is an elephant in the room about, you know, we can be as creative as we want, but when you have Elliot Schoenberg describing, you know, an educator at large category of women rabbis really means underemployed and, you know, not able to put enough together to make a parnassa for themselves. But I, you know, I think we've said that enough. My question is, thinking also about what the pilgrimages were saying about the traditional synagogue model, it's not only the boringness that sort of turns people off, but also the patriarchy that, whether they actually experienced it or imagined that that would be their experience, how are women rabbis uniquely situated to create the alternative access points for people who are not going to walk into synagogues for the, for that reason?
Great question.
Okay.
No, because responding to the first part of the monetary idea, most of what I've been able to do has been by finding funders to do it. So it's not just people outside institutions. And so I think there's sort of a bit of a sloughing of the reality here. Wherever you are situated inside institutions, if you want to do new things and break ground, you have to find the money. It's actually an economy that lends itself to that in certain ways because of the excess by some members of it. But then the particular situation of women in this, I think, has to do with perhaps being more ready to take certain risks or step outside of structures that have been there, maybe because they already don't fit so well. And so I think we are in a place often, and I wouldn't say this is only women, I think it's more not so gender-based, but there are individuals, predominantly maybe women, who are ready to, like, it doesn't fit so well. So you keep looking, and you keep figuring, and you push. And that to me is also just emblematic of who we can and have been and should be as a Jewish people, right? It's not, and maybe women are leading the way in that, but I think that's for everyone.
Maybe you can restate it a little. I'm sure I'm just not following.
My question is, if 90% of the Jewish community is opting out of synagogue life, if part of that is also a distaste for what they have experienced as patriarchy in formal religious settings, how are women rabbis situated to create different access points and you know, uniquely qualified and appropriate for the work outside of the pulpit?
I don't know. I think that these things are unfolding. You know, nothing happens in a vacuum. So the ordination of women, and I would include our Reform and Reconstructionist and post-denominational colleagues, but the introduction of women as rabbis now in much greater numbers than way back is having a great impact. I think we have to look a little retrospectively to see what the impact is and to analyze that. Two things. One is the first day, the day that we registered for classes in that first class, there were reporters there. And I remember a reporter, like from the Times or something, coming over to me and saying, we were waiting in line, because you didn't, you know, register online then, right?
Yes.
Waiting online, physically online, right? In line, online. And, you know, and then you go around the room, you paid this much, and then you know, you register for this.
Yeah.
And so this reporter from the Times comes over to me, and he says,
what impact will women have on the rabbinate? And I'm a conservative rabbinate on the rabbinate. And I said, well, I don't know, because I haven't even gone to one class yet, you know? So I think some of it's a little premature, but I will say this. When I came to my first job at the Cane Street Synagogue in Brooklyn, where I'd been put through the ringer in terms of how many, you know, meetings and tryouts and all that stuff, but I got the job over a lot of men. So I go into my office, it's my first rabbi's study, and what do I see on every freaking wall? Pictures of rabbis with these long beards. And they're all old, too, and I wasn't so old then. And I just thought, like, I got to take these guys down. That's the first thing I'm doing. I took all the guys down, put them in my closet. And, you know, some were, besides the fact that it was very bad art, you know, I was like, who really needs, you know, needlepoint rabbis with beards? But anyway, I took them all down, put them in the closet, and I thought to myself, they already have this picture in their minds. They don't need it to be on the walls of my study. But it's a liberating thing, too, because we didn't and don't look like the picture in people's minds. Nothing against people who look like that. Some of them are in this very room. But because of that, because of the changed visual, it was like, wait a second. And what, when we first started out, I'll speak for myself. I wanted to just be a rabbi. I wanted to just be a regular rabbi. You know, and I think in a pioneer generation, you just want to be accepted as an authentic rabbi. You didn't want to be a woman rabbi and, you know, all that stuff. So now, I you know, in the intervening years, like, forget about that. I'm a woman. Hear me roar. You know, I'm a woman. My femaleness is certainly as much a part of me as my rabbiness. And so now I'm so completely comfortable with, you know, a holistic view of myself. And I think when people, I do think that when people experience women who are rabbis, number one, they realize you don't look like the picture in their mind. Number two, they realize, oh, she's just a rabbi. But number three, it also opens, like, maybe there are other new thought. Jamie, you spoke to this yesterday in that first session. It opens up the possibility of change. And the last thing I want to say about that is, we became rabbis precisely at the moment when the key institution of Jewish life, the synagogue, began undergoing tremendous transformation. And when all kinds of, and it's not just the Jews, for goodness sake, it's everybody, right? Church, I'm telling you, you know, it's not, right? These are big sociological changes and forces, and it's a perfect storm. And that's when we became rabbis, at the beginning of this whole thing. So it's like a collision of all different changes.
Can I just say one thing? I think I heard the question a little bit differently. I'm trying to figure out when you use this word patriarchy. Like, I'm sitting here in 2015, and it like hits me like, oh, I haven't heard that word in a long time. And I'm trying to really struggle with my reaction to hearing it right now. So I would say that, you know, there are, I don't think they know if this is your question, but this is what I want to say. Like, as women have gotten experience and gotten more senior jobs, they do find themselves in positions of power and institutional responsibility. And all institutions have some kind of hierarchy. And it doesn't really mean it's necessarily patriarchal, but that's sort of how institutions work, right? There has to be somebody who makes decisions. There has to be somebody who's the last. But when you attain those positions, how you act in those jobs can really reflect on A, who you are in all of your humanness and personhood, whether you have the title rabbi, whether you're a female, whether you're a man, you know what I'm saying? I don't really think we're going to get rid of some of that. I mean, sometimes it gets a little flatter, but there's always going to be somebody, male or female, who is the head of that institution. You know what I'm saying? And so, and how that person acts trickles down to how other people in that institution feel. So I will give you one amazing example that I experienced. I work at the JCC Manhattan. It's run by Rabbi Joy Levin, who's an incredible mentor. She called the entire staff together when she had to lay off the maintenance company that had been the maintenance crew of the JCC for 10 years. And she had to explain why she had to let them go and why the decision financially was to bring on another group of people to do the same job. And she took questions because people had relationships with these people for a decade and they were going to lose their job. And she knew that people in the institution would have feelings about it. And she didn't want it to become a worker, and she didn't want people within the institution to start tweeting and to start Facebooking against the institution, like the JCC was laying off these workers, and because they found another company that could clean the building for less, which is really what they found. Mm-hmm. You know, and she wanted to tell them that they had negotiated for weeks with the prior company to try to tell them that they needed to do something differently or else their workers would be out of job. Anyways, on and on. And I was like, wow, that's amazing that she did that. I thought, like, it was an incredible model that she was thinking, like, way up and down the organizational ladder. It's a big organization, right? And how to treat everybody and allow everybody to ask her these typical questions. So, I can't really address patriarchy anymore. But I can say that we want to celebrate people who get these positions of power. Let's say power is not necessarily bad, but then once we attain them, we want to think about how we really are a role model and how all those relationships, you know, we model for others trickle down.
I just want to do a quick reflection on the chaplaincy field because there's some problematic dynamics here, which are that for the first time you now have women choosing chaplaincy as a career, and rather than it being the Parnassa profession of retiring men. And the Parnassa profession of retiring men is growing right now. So we have a wave of finishing their 27-year congregation men who are going and doing a chaplaincy residence and thinking they can walk in, and they don't need to earn what the 40, 30-something-year-old woman needs walking into that position as a chosen profession. And it's becoming, to me, a really problematic dynamic because those women often are choosing this because it really is the best use of their strengths and their qualities. The men are doing it as a sort of nahanta in their Parnassa years. Okay, I'm not trying to be too obnoxious, but it's really bothering me because what I see is, in terms of who's in the lead, the big and established organizations are quite happy to pay someone less and get a gray beard.
Yeah.
And I apologize for my obnoxiousness, but what you're seeing is men, some of those people need to step aside and find a different way of living out that part of their life, potentially, because it's directly getting in the way of younger women rabbis taking what are... It's only by being in one of those positions that she's going to then get hired to be, for example, the head of chaplaincy at Mass General, which, you know, or whatever, right? She can get into that position, but she needs to have one of those other jobs first. And if she is paid too low for that because she's in competition with retiring rabbis, it's a big problem. So it's something I'd like to see the movement address, but I see it happening out there in a big way.
I also think it has to do with the professionalization of chaplaincy. And that chaplains, there needs to be a standard. So even if you are switching into this as a second or third career, that is the standard of pay. It shouldn't be that you say, well, I'll go into it and I'll take less because I can afford it. There should be a standard of pay.
Well, we have 5 minutes. We'll take your question. Yeah.
My question is a little different from what I was thinking.
Fine.
So when thinking about... how do we take this out of the full public? I think about as a public rabbi, what does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it's a question of changing the models of how we think about our rabbinate and our congregations. So there are two main questions. One, I don't think there is a good answer, which is how to manage time and family and life and work and all those things, which is an anxiety right now for me.
You're still pregnant. It's like
unbelievable.
I don't want to be your
friend. That's awesome, right?
But then the other question is how we educate our leadership, our board members, our communities, that our work doesn't happen just in the walls of our synagogue. And I'm very blessed and lucky to be in a synagogue in a community that are very open to that. And still, I'm challenged. And still, I'm challenged by the idea that my rabbinate is not just what happens inside of my building. And I think that's what we need to break. That's the model. So, any thoughts or comments?
Well, just to say, just as the Rabbinical Assembly is undergoing a strategic plan, I know that the United Synagogue has, Steve Wardick is putting together a group of people to look at, yet again, but he's very serious, and he's made incredible changes to the executive director of the United Synagogue, is putting together a committee to sort of look at what are the strategic changes that need to be in place in congregations. And one of those is lay leadership and congregants' own self-image of what their congregation should be and the roles that their rabbi should play, not only within the congregation, but beyond the congregational walls. So I think, again, communicating with the top leadership about these visioning structures that could change the ways our basic assumptions of how we build our institutions could be very helpful. So anybody who's got your same concerns, write to Steve Wernick and, but if the United Synagogue improves and strengthens,
maybe some more congregations where
yes. 3 minutes.
My name is Bitlet, and I work for Weber School and Rights in Israel. And I just want to share with you a story that I really feel that I should say it out loud. The way you said that Torah is what really drives us. And last Independence Day, Haaretz had this really big project that they gave the reporters a chance to each of them to choose an alternative torch like they had in the big ceremony. And the reporter who works on all the social justice issues in Israel has chosen me, which was a big honor. And then he calls me and he said, well, I know that you're a rabbi, and I know that you went for women's movements, but are you doing this for religious reasons? And I said, well, you know, I would have never done it otherwise than religious reasons. This is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And then he had this, he wrote things beautifully about me and about my religious vision and why do I have a social justice religious vision, which in Israel sounds the most unnormal thing.
Addiction in terms.
Most of the organizations I work with are a social justice organization, and I come in and I'm saying, okay, so I come from other human rights and I'm a rabbi, and everybody looks